Hello, and welcome to Admission Insight, a podcast series designed to help your family gain insight into the independent school world and the application process. My name is Sharon Jarbo, and I'm Director of Admission and Financial Aid here at the Pennington School in New Jersey, and I'm seated with two of my favorite colleagues, Billy Hockey on my admission team, and Joe Prokop, the director of our Cervone Center for Learning. Hey, Billy.
Good morning, Sharon.
Hi, Joe.
Good morning.
So, Billy, what do you have planned today for our episode?
So we've asked Joe to join us today. Joe is the director of our Cervone Center for Learning. And we're going to have a conversation about neurodiversity, learning differences, and how this Varsity Blues scandal has impacted those areas.
So you say you want to apply to private school. We're going to show you what to do. Walk through the steps to take. And everything's going to turn out great. We're going to find the right fit. Both for you and for your kids. Based off school culture and needs. We're going to bolster your chances to succeed.
So one thing that I just want to say is that I'm so pleased to welcome Joe to the program this morning because she has more than 25 years of experience in working with students with learning differences in all different capacities. And anyone who knows of Pennington and our Cervone Center knows of some of the truly wonderful work that she inspires. So Joe, you and I were recently talking about this Varsity Blues scandal, and you were mentioning how it is negatively impacting students with learning differences who have just recently started to make gains. Can you talk a little bit about your concerns and what's going on?
Right. Well, the concerns are really on several different levels, but the basic framework for my thinking about this is that there are students out there, many students out there, who legitimately should have things like extended time on tests. And it is already hard enough for those kids. It's hard enough in school. It's hard enough to navigate the world of school and tests and misunderstandings, myths about learning disability and about accommodations. And then to have a situation like Varsity Blues, where people were gaming the system, absolutely inappropriate. As David Flame from Project Eye to Eye said, you know, we shouldn't be in a position where we're shaming others, but they deserve it. This was something that was done that's reprehensible. And the piece of it that has to do with faking a disability so that one can have extended time has led to, I think, this concept that it's the responsibility of the student with a disability to now double down on making their case, right? Rather than actually looking at what happened. And what happened, from what I understand, is that those who were gaming the system were getting things like extended time in order to make it easier to cheat. So perhaps making sure that that time would allow for answers to be changed, or that the tests themselves could be identified, or the SSD coordinator, the Services for Students with Disabilities coordinator at the school could perhaps do something, or a proctor. But we stand back, and there's sort of this thought that it was just about getting extended time, right? So a student who didn't need extended time was going to do better on the test because of that accommodation. Now, the research is a little murky on this, but the College Board has also done research to show that, you know, students who don't need extended time do not significantly benefit from that, right? So this was not about taking a student, an individual, and giving that student more time, and therefore all of a sudden they're scoring at a level that would get them admitted to these high-powered schools, right? So I think my humble opinion is we should be looking at what happened with the cheating, not with reactions to kids who might need extended time because they have a disability. Like I said, the life is hard enough to navigate, the life of schooling. without having to bear that added responsibility. I was particularly concerned, for example, that NAIS came out with a statement. It was brief. I'm hoping it's not their final word on this, but in their reaction to just the piece about the standardized tests, they had been giving advice to independent schools to more closely scrutinize applications for accommodations, and perhaps going so far as to then scrutinize the psychologists and neuropsychologists that were providing the testing, and perhaps only accepting testing from certain professionals. Now, if you're at the school level and you're an SSD coordinator, you do have a due diligence responsibility to both of the testing agencies to make sure that your applications are in line with College Board and ACT criteria, including what that documentation looks like, what kind of professional did it. In other words, the hurdles are already in place, right? And they're pretty complicated. You know, they're certainly complicated from the standpoint of looking at what will, for example, benefit a student versus what the College Board or ACT will allow. And anyone at the school level who's an SSD coordinator, like I am for the Pennington School, needs to do their due diligence and keep in line with that. But this thought that somehow you come up with more hurdles for the individual with a learning disability is shocking, disheartening, all of that.
It's outrageous.
Mm-hmm. So, Joe, I want to return to something that you mentioned there about the myths that surround learning disabilities. Could you explain a little bit, what are some of the most common myths surrounding students with a learning disability? And then kind of on the contrary, what would you want the audience to know about students who do have a learning difference?
I'm actually going to start, Billy, with the second part of your question. And that is that in order to understand what a learning disability is, we have to think about the fact that that student does have weaknesses that might be associated with reading, for example, or other aspects of learning. But definitional to having a learning disability is also having strengths, right? That's why when we look at a psychoeducational evaluation or a neuropsychoeducational evaluation, we're not just looking at those weaknesses or even deficits in some cases. We're looking at the pattern of strengths and weaknesses. That is, again, definitional. If I tell this to kids sometimes when we're talking about their learning profiles, if it were all weaknesses, that's not a learning disability. That's absolutely not. There's always those strengths. Now, in terms of myths, those play out in a number of different ways. At independent schools, for example, unfortunately have a history of not just the school itself, I'm not blaming schools, but they're part of society and they're part of that sort of myth-making. That, for example, if one embraces as a school this idea of working with a diverse community of learners, that somehow that's going to threaten the academic rigor of the school, right? That's a myth that is still out there, and it's unfortunate because what we know is that it's absolutely not the case. I can look at strengths that students that they can bring to bear. I can look at this in any number of ways, but the bottom line is there's no threat to academic rigor. That has to do with a myth having to do with what one needs to do to meet the needs of individuals with learning differences or disabilities. And that one might have to, for example, water down the curriculum or change expectations, somehow modify the curriculum to meet that student's needs. We know that is not the case, but that's still out there. There are myths that go much more to the student experience. For example, if I loop back to talking about things like extended time, there may be students in the same classroom or grade or school who think, neurotypical kids, that is, who think, wow, you know, if I had extended time, I would do better also, right? So they may be having a negative thought associated with those students who do need extended time. There's an analogy, it's a weak analogy, it's far from perfect, but there's an analogy that I use with kids all the time about the reading glasses that I have on my head at all times when I'm not reading. And if you were to give me a reading test, but you said, no, you cannot use that accommodation, right? You cannot use your reading glasses. Now I'm trying to read, and you're testing me on it, and you think, oh gosh, she really didn't understand anything about what she read. Well, you don't have a measure of what I understood from reading. You have a measure of my visual acuity, right? You're measuring the wrong thing. So I need to put on my reading glasses and then read, and then you can test me on what I understood. And the fact that I wear reading glasses takes away from no one else. Absolutely has no effect whatsoever on someone else's reading experience. If I were to hand you my reading glasses, that's not going to boost your performance, right? Unless you happen to need the same prescription that I do. But so there is this thought that students with learning disabilities are getting something, you know, that is not unique to them. It would benefit everyone. That's a very common myth. But there are others, and sometimes those are overt in terms of how they play out, affecting either the school or the individual or a family. You know, there's that misunderstanding that some kids have had. That's, I think, the most devastating myth of all. When their needs have not been met by a school, the school has not done right by them, but they feel less worthy. They feel less than intelligent. They feel it's something about who they are that's wrong. And of course, that's the most painful myth of all.
So, Joe, when I had the privilege of teaching here at the Pennington School for 5 years, my classroom was blessed every year with a neurodiverse group of students. And I have to say that I agree with you that there was no weakening of the standards in my class. In fact, it was often the students with learning differences who upheld those standards to a T, by working the hardest, by asking actually for the smallest favors. Accommodations are not favors, but they ask for no special consideration beyond those. And they were the best classmates to everyone else because they never assumed that anything was easy. And I just wanted to have you explain a little bit about, you often say that the best practices for students with learning differences are just the best practices for everyone. And I started to grab onto that a little bit with my class, but I would love for you to explain that to everyone.
Well, that phrase is actually embedded in the mission statement for the Cervone Center for Learning. So Edmund Cervone clearly understood, as he wrote, that the best practices for meeting the needs of students with learning differences or disabilities are the best practices. I'd rather start by just looking at what that looks like at 20,000 feet rather than in a particular classroom. What looking at teaching and learning from a best practices approach requires is that teachers think deeply and frequently about their goals for each lesson, for the year, for each unit, all pieces of this. What are you really after? What are the core understandings that every student should leave your classroom understanding at the end of the day, right? So that you can question on a regular basis whether or not there's a piece of that that needs to be done in the same way by every learner in the classroom, and therefore that you need to present in a highly specified way. So if one thinks more broadly about understandings, for example, then you might be less concerned with something like a reading skill assessment that involves reading skills if that's not the core of the understanding, because kids might be finding another path in order to get to that text, to get to that understanding. Now, some of that is for the student, as you said, Sharon, the qualities that students who have had to work hard at learning and understand that they have to work harder or work differently, or some combination of that, is tremendous. But as long as teachers are willing to think and rethink what it is that they're after, what their goals are, how they approach learning, and there's an issue about the ways that we go about practices in schools in general, where we don't question that, and we typically will start to think about what makes sense. Let's think about extended time, for example. Very often, educators want to have some kind of a limit on that. Let's say 50% extended time. It's very common. Well, who's to say that 50% is the precise amount of time for an individual student in every single class, regardless of the format of the test, right? So it's artificial, and often, I hate to say this, it's often based on what is convenient, right? And what's common, what you think is a practice that goes on everywhere, rather than thinking about what is going to ensure that this individual student has had the opportunity to demonstrate all that they know and understand. And that might not be convenient because it may require something like oral retesting. Perhaps that teacher has noticed that in a classroom discussion or on homework assignments, in various ways that student has demonstrated a deep understanding of that particular part of the curriculum. And yet when they take the test, even with, say, a 50% extended time accommodation, they didn't do well. Well, all that best practices says is let me question whether or not I was measuring what I was hoping that I was measuring, right? That this student has had an opportunity to demonstrate what they know and understand. And so, as you can see, this would play out in a variety of ways. Our teachers at the Pennington School are so fortunate because they have, you know, a large number of learning specialists who are part of the Cervone Center who can talk through these kinds of approaches, whether it's an assessment practice or a teaching practice, and really think about those individuals in the classroom. And I wouldn't have the expectation that every subject teacher has a full repertoire of best practices. It really needs to be an ongoing conversation that we try to have without making assumptions, like because I've seen 50% extended time many times, that must be the thing. And we just need to learn how to question it. Again, that's the large picture. There can be all sorts of practices that play out. And those might be particular to a discipline or a broader area like humanities. And I think, again, one of the things that we all have to be willing to do as educators to meet that best practices is to reflect on everything and talk with one another. I would say there's one practice that stands in opposition to this, and that it's the teacher who says, I'm going to close my classroom, and it's my way or the highway. But short of that, once we start talking, once we start reflecting, once we start paying attention to those individual learners in the classroom, that's when you open up a best practices approach.
So much of it seems to boil down to that paying attention to the individual student, whether they're a typical high flyer or a student who's been classified with a learning difference or someone who's been sort of thought of in the middle. When we see them as individuals, the potential all of a sudden seems to skyrocket, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
So, Joe, we are almost out of time, but before we sign off, is there any final words or advice that you want to share with the audience out there?
Well, if parents of students with learning differences are trying to find that best match school, certainly thinking about your child's individual needs. There's not one thing that we can say in terms of students with learning differences. In other words, they are as a diverse group as any other group of students. So I think the first thing to be doing is looking at that match with other schools on a host of, you know, different factors. But schools that do have smaller class sizes, that have a sensitive and thoughtful teaching faculty. You know, I've been at the Pennington School for 24 years, so it's hard for me to talk about other schools. But because we come at this from a long history of embracing a diverse population of learners, I know that that benefits not only our students who have learning differences or disabilities, it benefits all students, right? Those same kind of best practices that demand that teachers reflect on their practice to really think about what's working or not working. Those are the same things that benefit all learners, but it also means that for that student who has a learning difference, that their experience will be about what they can do and not what they presumably can't do. And so those things are going to be hard to assess as families are moving through the application process. Absolutely. But look to those things about a school culture and community that says the room is there, the door is open for our teachers to think about what's working and not working, that we really do want to embrace working with students with learning differences. If I loop back to where we started about Varsity Blues, that this is not a school that reacted in terms of making it harder for kids to get accommodations, that more highly scrutinized the psychologist who was doing the testing. If you see a school that's all of a sudden putting up barriers, then I would question it. I would.
Great. Well, Joe, thanks so much for joining us. This has been a rich conversation. And for all of you out there, we'll catch you next time on Admission Insight.
So you say you want to apply to private school. We're gonna show you what to do. Walk through the steps to take.